Our second speaker this morning is our brother Ron Cowie of the Golden Grove Ecclesia in South Australia. And the theme for Brother Ron's classes this week is Look Unto the Rock From Hence You Are Hewn. Today's class is entitled Joseph, Living Always in the Sight of God. We'll turn it over to our brother Ron.
The chairman and my dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and our dear young people. One of the very first lessons that we teach our little children is that God sees all things. It's rather a sad truth, but as we get older, we tend by our actions to show that we don't believe it quite so much ourselves. We're going to see in the loveliest of Jacob's sons, even in Joseph, an incredible God consciousness. He was a man who always lived in the sight of God and convinced always that God was watching every moment of his life. Now, we left Joseph screaming with terror at the bottom of that empty pit at Dothan. After a long time, as it must have seemed to him, a rope eventually came down. And we can only imagine the tremendous sense of relief with which Joseph found himself being hauled out of the pit, only to find himself on sale, like a lump of meat. To find himself the process of an undignified bargaining deal, as would have been done with the Ishmaelites, seeing the value that his brothers actually put upon him. You can imagine Joseph pleading to his brothers and his pleas being met with hate-filled stares. We will see what becomes of your dreams. Until finally he was sold by his brothers for 20 pieces of silver, which really was a pittance. 2 pieces of silver each. Later on, brethren and sisters, they couldn't wait to get rid of the silver out of their sacks. They hated the sight of money by the time that Joseph and God had finished with them. But for 2 pieces of silver each, they were willing to sell their own brother into slavery. And so he would have been chained up, lashed with whips, stumbling off towards Egypt, half naked, his garments having been taken away from him, going into the unknown. And on that journey down to Egypt, you can imagine the worry that Joseph went through. What would his father be told? What would Benjamin think? What about his brother's spiritual future? And perhaps the hardest question of all that would have gone through the mind of Joseph, where is my God? How can God let this happen to me? Does God care? Is my faith in God misplaced? He wouldn't have been human, brethren and sisters, if he hadn't asked those questions of himself. And then arriving in Egypt to be placed once again through a humiliating slave cell. Remember, this is a child brought up in a very protected environment with a father that loved him dearly. A humiliating slave sale in Egypt. And he finds himself sold once again. And when he finds out that the person who's bought him is the chief executioner of Egypt, that would hardly be comforting. He was bought by Potiphar, the man who kept the prisoners on death row. It was hardly what you would term an ideal employer to choose. And I just wonder what the Ishmaelites got for Joseph when they got to Egypt. I like to think they made 50% profit. They paid 20 pieces of silver. How fitting it would be if they made 50% profit and got 30 pieces of silver for him. And so chapter 37 ends. Very, very dramatically it says, he was sold unto Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh's, the chief executioner, as the margin correctly renders it. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but chapter 39 says, and Joseph was brought down to Egypt. And in between we have chapter 38. And when the Bible does this, by just inserting a chapter that seems right out of place, we need to ask the question, why is this here? The record is incredibly just interrupted by chapter 38, which is all about the sad record of Judah's life. Now that's a very deliberate background to what happens in chapter 39 to Joseph. What the divine penman does here is to insert a snapshot which covers 25 years of the life of Judah. And there are 2 reasons why this is done. Firstly, to make Judah's later conversion and his later sensitivity even more dramatic than it would otherwise be. So it's to make Judah's later conversion and sensitivity dramatic, but also it's here to highlight the difference between Judah and the virtues of Joseph. And so we have a contrast between chapter 38, between a man who forsakes Abrahamic family principles, who commits adultery with the world, compared to Joseph in chapter 39, who absolutely refuses the opportunity to commit adultery with the world. And so chapter 39, which covers 25 years of the life of Judah, is just dropped in here to make that contrast. Now I have here a suggested chronology, and I think the overheads are going to be given out sometime today. A suggested chronology of Judah and Joseph and Jacob. This gives you some idea of what was happening in the life of Judah in comparison to the time of the life of Joseph. Now in chapter 38, Judah goes out into the world, marries a Canaanite, has three sons, the sons grow to marriageable age, take wives for themselves. God kills two of those sons, and then the third son is not given after a long period of time to one of the widows. So we're actually looking at a period of some 25 odd years that's covered in the life of Judah. And to make it fit into the chronology, you've got to see that probably what happened is that no sooner are they back in the land of promise than Judah's out there marrying a Canaanite. Perhaps when Joseph is only about 10 years old, Judah goes out and does what he does with the Canaanites. Now I want you to notice chapter 38 and verse 1. We're going to give a brief resume of chapter 38 that we might then appreciate the value of chapter 39. It says in verse 1 that Judah went down from his brethren. You know, the Bible's always graphic, isn't it? He went down spiritually as well as physically. He went down because he made friends with the Canaanite. Now here was a total contradiction to the family policy of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob. You know, the record says three times in this chapter, in verse 1, in verse 12 and verse 20, that he had a friend in the world. And friends are always a critical influence, particularly upon those who are young. And brethren and sisters, we need to understand that in allowing what friends our children have, we have a great responsibility in discerning the company that they keep. We read in the Bible that Dinah, the daughter of Leah, went out to see the daughters of the land. She only wanted to find out what the girls of Shechem were doing and wearing. She found herself corrupted by a prince of Shechem because she was in bad company. Amnon had a friend, one of the sons of David, and his name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. He taught Amnon how to commit fornication with his own sister. And Amnon lost his life. Some friend was Jonadab. And so the advice of the New Testament is this: keep a strong curb on your youthful cravings and strive for integrity, good faith, love and peace in company with all who pray to the Lord with a pure heart. And for our young people and for our parents guiding young people, the sort of company your children need are those who can pray with you and with your children to God that they might be able to live a good life of integrity. That's the sort of relationship that we need for our children and our young people need for themselves. Good company that is positive with all that pray to the Lord with a pure heart. You don't find that in the daughters of Canaan. And that's where Judah went. And we have the principle of the 1 Corinthians 15 verse 33, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. You've got to be discriminating in the company your children and your teenagers keep. And particularly when they're out there in the world, be very, very concerned to know who and what they are spending their time with. Because never think, brethren and sisters, that your child, having been brought up in the truth, will automatically convert the unspiritual. Because when you look at it, you've actually got two carnal minds and perhaps half a spiritual one to contend with it. And I've seen parents make the dramatic mistake of thinking that their children will influence children in the world to be better people. And sometimes even the truth, the same problem arises. We've got to be very critical and understand that bad company will ruin good morals. Well, for Judah, the next step was inevitable. If you're out there amongst the Canaanites and he had a friend who was a certain Adullamite named Hira, Well, lo and behold, in verse 2, he saw there a certain Canaanite woman whose name was Shua. And if you're going to spend your time out with the Canaanites, lo and behold, you will see pretty Canaanite women. And so Judah now marries outside the faith. At a time when Jacob has done his level best to keep his family separate from the world, when he resisted the policy of the Hivites, who came to him and said, "We will let our sons marry your daughters, and your sons can marry our daughters, and we'll all be one happy family here in Canaan." And Jacob said, "Absolutely not." But Judah has let the side down. And within 5 years of being in the land, he's out there married to a Canaanite woman. And I've got no doubt that Hira was his best man. The Canaanite policy was always conquest by intermarriage, as you can read from chapter 34 and verse 21 to 24. And our friends in the world are very happy to help us bury our principles. They will help you sin. Look at verse 20. And Judah sent the kid. He's paying off a harlot now. And who does he send to pay the harlot? By his friend, the Adullamite. 20 years later, Hira is still helping him to do the wrong thing. And from friends in the world, you don't get words of caution and saying, "Well, isn't this a bit wrong before your God?" No, he says, "I'll go and pay for you, Judah. I'm happy to pay your harlots." Brethren and sisters, people in the world are happy to see us bury our principles. We had a young couple in our meeting whose grandparents were not in the truth. They knew that the family had taken a stand against having a television in the home. When one of those grandchildren married, the grandparents, who were not in the truth, gave the new young couple a television and then made it a policy to drop off all these interesting videos that the poor kids had missed out on while their parents were bringing them up. And you see, the world will fall over themselves to help you fill in the wells of Abraham. Friends in the world, brethren and sisters, we need to understand, are not going to help us spiritually. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't preach the truth. We will see in a moment that Joseph was a prime example of preaching to others. What I am saying is that if we've got friends that we're comfortable with on worldly terms, that's a problem. Because bad company will ruin good morals. Well, 20 years went by from when he married Shua. Two sons, the first two sons, grew up to be so unspiritual before God that God had to slay them. What a surprise. When you bury your principles, what do you expect your children to be? Because they were half Canaanites. And then Judah's wife is taken away. And then he goes chasing after what he thought was a harlot, was actually his daughter-in-law. I want you to notice that this 20 years of Judah's life, there is no sense of shame or fear about what Judah does. So look at the process of sin. Verse 23, see how there's no concept of God. He said in verse 23, and Judah said, when they couldn't find the harlot, well, he said, "Let her keep the pledge, lest we be shamed." And see what the margin says, "We become a contempt. Behold, I sent the kid and you haven't found her." The only thing that bothered Judah about what he'd done with that harlot was that he wanted everyone to understand that he tried to pay for his harlotry. He could not care a whit at that stage what God thought about what he'd done. He was only concerned with the public appearance of things. Look again at verse 26. And Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I gave her not to Shelah my son." So you see, he didn't actually come up with the fact that he'd sinned against God. He admitted he'd sinned against Tamar. But he still wasn't saying, "I have sinned against God." What about his family principles? What about what he was doing to the rest of Jacob's family by his example? What about his God? And it's been my very sad experience in ecclesial life trying to deal with some of these moral problems, that many people who are involved in gross moral sins seem to be far more concerned with the cover-up, with about not losing face in the eyes of their brethren and sisters, than really coming to grips with God's view of what they've done. They're more concerned about covering up and denying as much as they can, only letting you find out what they have to tell you, so that in public they might appear still to have their righteousness before men. It's a very sad fact, isn't it, that people want to cover up. Remember King Saul the other day in our readings? Here's Samuel saying, "God's rejected you, we're going to take the kingdom away," and all Saul can say is, "Just honour me in the eyes of the people for this day." It's a funny thing about human nature. We are so concerned what people think of us, and we forget what God, how God has been transgressed against. And David had to be reminded of that. You've made a great occasion for the enemies of Yahweh to blaspheme. And yet David was all concerned with cover-up. The second thing we find that comes from Judah's sin here is the hypocritical, judgmental attitude that so often comes out of people involved in moral sins. It's a strange thing about human nature that sometimes the harshest critics of the faults of other people are those who are hiding depravities of their own. It's a weird thing, brethren and sisters. I have seen people who were later shown to be the worst of pedophiles in our ecclesial circles, who before they were exposed were the harshest critics of everything that was done by the ecclesia and every other fault of other people. It's a weird thing that people become so harsh when they're hiding their own depravities. And what did Judah say when he found out that his daughter-in-law was with child? Well, look what he says. In verse 24, they came to Judah and they said, "Your daughter-in-law is expecting a child by whoredom." And Judah said, "Disgusting thing. What a wicked woman this is. Let's have her out here and let's burn her at the stake." A bit embarrassing when Tamar said, "Well, it's your child, Judah." But you see the judgmental attitude? It's a strange quirk of human nature that people become so poisonous because their mind is actually being poisoned by their own sin that their judgment becomes extremely severe on other people. What did David say when Nathan gave him the parable about the little ewe lamb? David knew the law that a man who steals a lamb has to restore the lamb fourfold. But David said, that man is going to die. Because you see, his own sin was eating away and he was very quick to pass judgment on other people. It's an evil poison, this sin on the mind. And we can only imagine, as this sad story of Judah unfolded, how that step by step, Jacob would have been getting hold of Joseph and Benjamin and saying, "Look here, boys, Judah is letting us all down. He's a disgrace to Abraham's family principles. Don't do this, boys. When you get in temptation, here's how you react." And you can imagine Jacob making those impressions upon his sons. And so we leave chapter 38 and we follow Joseph into Egypt. And you can see why chapter 38 is there, because we're going to see the opposite way to resist temptation in chapter 39. What a contrast to Judah we have here. Here's how to survive in spiritual Egypt. It's part of the curse that we have to go out into the world and earn our living. We have to go and work for Pharaoh's servants to make bricks. And in doing so, we find ourselves spending two-thirds of our waking life amongst people we would prefer perhaps not to be with. But that's the way it is. That's part of the curse. We've got to go out and work amongst Pharaoh's servants. And for our young people, at the age of about 17, like Joseph, they very often confront Egypt in all its glory. Whether it be going to work or going to college or university, that's the age they really come to grips with Egypt at its worst. I might just make a comment, brethren and sisters, to add a bit to what Brother Jonathan said this morning. I've travelled a little bit in the Brotherhood, and I might say that I believe that one of the greatest and saddest things that's happened to us in the last 20 years has been the unthoughtful sending of children away to study in other cities. It's something we need to be very conscious of, that the world is actually organising things so that often if children want to follow a particular course, they've got to leave home to do it. There was a time once when every course was available in your home city, but now they seem to be centralising things so that children have to go and live away from the influence of parents. And I would reckon from the people I've spoken to that there are parents all over the world who are regretting that their children went to live in university dormitories. I think it's a trend we need to fight against. If you can't find some education locally that's suitable, where your children are still at home and still under your eyes, then be very, very careful about the choice of their accommodation. Make sure if they're in another city that they're in regular contact with the ecclesia. I spoke to the recording brother of an ecclesia in England who said to me that his city was a university city. He said, "Sometimes we only find out that there are Christadelphian young people here when they come to the ecclesia in desperate situations." And he said it's a tragedy that parents don't even let the ecclesia know that their young people are in the city. We need to be very conscious that young people going away from home, and particularly living in the social life of the university colleges, are at great risk unless they have themselves well sorted out in the truth before they go. But our children do have to face the world, brethren and sisters. They do have to at some stage either go to work, go to college. They do have to stand upon their own two feet. And we've got to use those early years like Jacob did to make sure they know what to do when faced with temptation. Well, Joseph's demeanour was a timeless exhortation to everybody of every age. If ever there was a worker that had a good reason to go slow, to be resentful about his workplace, and to only do just enough to keep out of trouble, it was Joseph. He got no pay, no weekends off, no annual leave, no hope of ever being released at the end of 7 years like Hebrew slaves were, and he was there for something he hadn't done. If ever there was somebody that had a right to work slowly, it was Joseph. And yet we know that he worked heartily as unto the Lord. And he was soon noticed, as Christadelphians always ought to be in the workplace, noticed for being more diligent than everybody else. And so we find in chapter 39 in verse 5 and 6, it came to pass that Potiphar made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had. Soon he was in the position of total trust in the house of Potiphar. Potiphar would go off every day to whatever he did for entertainment, and he would let Joseph run all his affairs, gave him blank checks to sign. He trusted him completely to run his house. Incredible that this man was put in such a position. You can imagine Potiphar hardly believing his luck. He's got an honest slave who even works when the boss isn't watching. Incredible to have a man like this. Let's never think that our employers overwork us and underpay us. You try this for size. But you know, there was another dimension to Joseph. He actually told Joseph why it was that he was working so hard. Because it says in verse 3, his master saw that Yahweh was with him. And he saw in verse 5 that Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and that the blessing of Yahweh was upon him. How did Potiphar know anything about Yahweh? Well, it was Joseph who was telling him. You know, we find that one of the remarkable things about Joseph, that he preached to everybody, in season and out of season. He preached to Potiphar. He later on preaches to Potiphar's wife, who's casting her eyes upon him. He preaches to the prisoners who come down there about the God of the Hebrews. He preaches to Pharaoh about the God of the Hebrews. His own steward says that he's of the faith of Joseph. So here's a man that preaches to everybody he comes across, in season and out of season. Nobody misunderstands where Joseph's coming from in life. And that's the great thing about having made the stand and told them what you believe, you then have to live up to it. And so Joseph found it easy to keep working hard for nothing, because he'd said, well, I'm here at Yahweh's providence. So he had to keep working, didn't he? And that's not a bad way to be. If we make a clear stand, then we've got an obligation to show them that we're different. And there used to be a time, and perhaps still is, when employers would seek out Christadelphians to work for them because they were honest and diligent. But notice the incredible lesson that we get from Joseph here. He was a slave, he could not resign, he couldn't leave, but he continually preached about his God. You know, here's a man with an amazing conviction. It didn't matter whether it was Potiphar's wife or anyone else, he was always willing to preach. And brethren and sisters, let's not be intimidated by the world to be silent about the things that we believe. We have the one hope. We know where the world's going. We know what comes after death. We have meaning and purpose in our lives. We know what real joys and real hopes are. We have hundreds of real friends. Which of the people you work with could go back and say that they were with 500 friends for a whole week and every one of them would lend you $100? Which of your people at work could say that? That they've got 500 friends that you could go to and say, let me have $100, and they would trust you? They couldn't do that. We've got hundreds of friends, both here and all over the world, that are on the same wavelength. What a remarkable thing that we can walk into people's homes that we've never met before. And they don't hide the silverware. And we immediately are on the same wavelength. People at work just cannot understand our community because they don't trust anybody enough to have them in their homes unless they know them really well. Let's tell people about the wonderful community that we have. Be proud of who you are. Be proud of your Lord Jesus Christ. Be right up front and be positive about your beliefs. What a tragedy that most Christadelphians are known in the workplace as that strange fellow over there that doesn't buy lottery tickets, that doesn't go to the movies, or doesn't do this, or doesn't drink. We ought not to be known as the man who doesn't, or the woman who doesn't. We ought to be known as the person who does, who has a hope, who knows where they're going in life. And tell them about the things you do. If you find it hard to preach to people directly, then put up in your workplace conversation starters. You know, I work with a young Christadelphian girl who was rather shy and couldn't preach openly. So what she did is every time she went to a study weekend or a youth weekend, she would get all the photographs and put them all over her workstation. You know, she had more conversations on the truth than anybody I can remember. Somebody was saying, well, who's that? What's this? What's happening here? Who are those people? And she's got an opening to talk about the happy things that she does. So instead of only being known as the person who doesn't do this and doesn't go to the social club, she's the person who does things. And people are saying, boy, she's got lots of friends. What an interesting life you have. You're always going somewhere. And you see, we can actually show that we are a positive and happy people. We just lost a brother back in Adelaide to the article of death. He was the shyest man you could ever imagine. You know, he never ever fulfilled an ecclesial appointment. He was unable to get anywhere near a platform or even to chair a meeting in the home. He just went to pieces with his nerves. He never ever spoke a word in public in the Christadelphian Brotherhood. That man, in his lifetime, brought 17 people into the truth from his workplace. He had a simple policy. Every day he would go aside and read his own Bible. And God sent people flocking to that man to ask him, what is it you're reading? Why is that important to you? He never taught any of those people the truth himself. He would get them sufficiently interested and handball them to somebody else that he felt could teach them. But 17 people and their families that followed came from that one humble, quiet, unspoken brother. Incredible, brethren and sisters. There's a witness. Everybody at work knew what he stood for. And it didn't matter what company he worked for, he started knocking them off one by one. Amazing individual. You see, you can do it. Just be positive. Just show them who you are. Joseph told everybody who he was. Be a positive example of your faith. So we find that if we do that, God will be with us. No matter how bad things got for Joseph, we are assured again and again that Yahweh was with Joseph. It didn't mean that a Joseph would avoid trials. It didn't mean that things wouldn't go wrong. What it tells us is that God never left his side and he was always with him. Well, temptation came in the most difficult way in chapter 39. Here was a lonely young man, about 25 years of age. He was healthy and he was strong. Verse 6 tells us he was a goodly person and well favoured. Joseph was a normal young man with natural desires. His brother Benjamin, by the age of 32, had 10 children. Joseph is 25 and he's still single. And then he's confronted by Potiphar's wife. Now the record very clearly tells us that Potiphar was a eunuch, as many of the king's servants were. She's a woman that was aggressive and bold. And let me say to you, brethren and sisters, and particularly our young brethren in the workplace, Potiphar's wife is very much alive today. In our workplaces in Australia, I don't know what it's like here so much, but in Australia we have, in the last 15 years, a phenomenon of the two-income family. Far more women are now back in the workforce after having children. There are many relationships.